then there is no limit, no way out, no reality. She went on talking to him, and after a while it was about Washington again. He answered when it was necessary. He thought that he had believed it was a simple sequence, the past and the present, and if there was loss in the past, one was compensated by pain in the present, and pain gave it a form of immortality. But he had not known that one could destroy like this, kill retroactively, so that to her it had never existed. She glanced at her wristwatch and gave a little gasp of impatience. "I'm late already. I must run along." He said heavily, "Do you mind if I don't go with you, Katie? It's not rudeness. I just think it's better." "No, of course. Not at all. I'm quite able to find my way in the streets, and there's no need for formalities among old friends." She added, gathering her bag and gloves, crumpling a paper napkin into a ball, dropping it neatly into her teacup. "I'll give you a ring next time I'm in town, and we'll have a bite together again, though I can't promise when that will be. I'm so busy, I have to go so many places. Last month it was Detroit, and next week I'm flying to St. Louis. But when they shoot me out to New York again, I'll ring you up. So long, Peter, it was ever so nice." Chapter 11 Gail Winant looked at the shining wood of the yacht deck. The wood and a brass doorknob that had become a smear of fire gave him a sense of everything around him. The miles of space filled with sun, between the burning spreads of sky and ocean. It was February, and the yacht lay still, her engines idle, in the southern Pacific. He leaned on the rail and looked down at Rourke in the water. Rourke floated on his back, his body stretched into a straight line, arms spread, eyes closed. The tan of his skin implied a month of days such as this. Winan thought that this was the way he liked to apprehend space and time. Through the power of his yacht, through the tan of Rourke's skin, or the sun-brown of his own arms folded before him on the rail. He had not sailed his yacht for several years. This time he had wanted Rourke to be his only guest. Dominique was left behind. Winant had said, "You're killing yourself, Howard. You've been going at a pace nobody can stand for long, ever since Monadnock, isn't it? Think you'd have the courage to perform the feat most difficult for you? To rest?" He was astonished when Rourke accepted without argument. Rourke laughed. "I'm not running away from my work, if that's what surprises you. I know when to stop, and I can't stop unless it's completely. I know I've overdone it. I've been wasting too much paper lately and doing awful stuff." "Do you ever do awful stuff?" "Probably more of it than any other architect, and with less excuse. The only distinction I can claim is that my botches end up in my own wastebasket. I warn you, we'll be away for months. If you begin to regret it and cry for your drafting table in a week, like all men who've never learned a loaf, I won't take you back. I'm the worst kind of dictator aboard my yacht. You'll have everything you can imagine, except paper or pencils. I won't even leave you any freedom of speech, no mention of girders, plastics, or reinforced concrete once you step on board. I'll teach you to eat, sleep, and exist like the most worthless millionaire."
"I'd like to try that."
The work in the office did not require Rourke's presence for the next few months. His current jobs were being completed. Two new commissions were not to be started until spring. He had made all the sketches Keating needed for Cortland. The construction was about to begin. Before sailing, on a day in late December, Rourke went to take a last look at the site of Cortland. An anonymous spectator in a group of the idle curious, he stood and watched the steam shovels biting the earth, breaking the way for future foundations. The East River was a broad band of sluggish black water, and beyond, in a sparse haze of snowflakes, the towers of the city stood softened, half suggested in watercolors of orchid and blue. Dominique did not protest when Winant told her that he wanted to sail on a long cruise with Rourke. "Dearest, you understand that it's not running away from you. I just need some time taken out of everything. Being with Howard is like being alone with myself, only more at peace."
"Of course, Gail. I don't mind."
But he looked at her, and suddenly he laughed, incredulously pleased.
"Dominique, I believe you're jealous."
"It's wonderful. I'm more grateful to him than ever, if it could make you jealous of me." She could not tell him that she was jealous. Or of whom. The yacht sailed at the end of December. Rourke watched, grinning. Winan's disappointment when Winan found that he needed to enforce no discipline. Rourke did not speak of buildings, lay for hours stretched out on deck in the sun, and loafed like an expert. They spoke little. There were days when Winan could not remember what sentences they had exchanged. It would have seemed possible to him that they had not spoken at all. Their serenity was their best means of communication. Today they had dived together to swim, and Winan had climbed back first. As he stood at the rail watching Rourke in the water, he thought of the power he held in this moment. He could order the yacht to start moving, sail away, and leave that red-headed body to sun and ocean. The thought gave him pleasure, the sense of power, and the sense of surrender to Rourke and the knowledge that no conceivable force could make him exercise that power. Every physical instrumentality was on his side, a few contractions of his vocal cords giving the order, and someone's hand opening a valve, and the obedient machine would move away. He thought, it's not just a moral issue, not the mere horror of the act. One could conceivably abandon a man if the fate of a continent depended on it. But nothing would enable him to abandon this man. He, Gale Winand, was the helpless one in this moment, with the solid planking of the deck under his feet. Rourke, floating like a piece of driftwood, held a power greater than that of the engine in the belly of the yacht. Winand thought, because that is the power from which the engine has come. Rourke climbed back on deck. Winand looked at Rourke's body, at the threads of water running down the angular planes. He said, "You made a mistake on the Stoddard Temple, Howard. That statue should have been not of Dominique, but of you." "No, I'm too egotistical for that."
"Egotistical? An egotist would have loved it. You use words in the strangest way."
"In the exact way. I don't wish to be the symbol of anything. I'm only myself."
Stretched in a deck chair, Winand glanced up with satisfaction at the lantern, a disk of frosted glass on the bulkhead behind him. It cut off the black void of the ocean and gave him privacy within solid walls of light. He heard the sound of the yacht's motion. He felt the warm night air on his face. He saw nothing but the stretch of deck around him, enclosed and final. Rourke stood before him at the rail, a tall white figure leaning back against black space, his head lifted as Winand had seen it lifted in an unfinished building. His hands clasped the rail. The short shirt sleeves left his arms in the light. Vertical ridges of shadow stressed the tensed muscles of his arms and the tendons of his neck. Winand thought of the yacht's engine, of skyscrapers, of transatlantic cables, of everything man had made.
"Howard, this is what I wanted, to have you here with me."
"I know."
"Do you know what it really is?"
"Avarice.
I'm a miser about two things on earth, you and Dominique. I'm a millionaire who's never owned anything. Do you remember what you said about ownership? I'm like a savage who's discovered the idea of private property and run amok on it. It's funny. Think of Ellsworth Toohey."
"Why Ellsworth Toohey?"
"I mean the things he preaches. I've been wondering lately whether he really understands what he's advocating. Selflessness in the absolute sense? Well, that's what I've been. Does he know that I'm the embodiment of his ideal? Of course he wouldn't approve of my motive, but motives never alter facts. If it's true selflessness he's after in the philosophical sense, and Mr. Toohey is a philosopher, in a sense much beyond matters of money, why, let him look at me. I've never owned anything. I've never wanted anything. I didn't give a damn. In the most cosmic way Toohey could ever hope for. I made myself into a barometer subject to the pressure of the whole world. The voice of his masses pushed me up and down. Of course I collected a fortune in the process. Does that change the intrinsic reality of the picture? Suppose I gave away every penny of it. Suppose I had never wished to take any money at all, but had set out in pure altruism to serve the people. What would I have to do? Exactly what I've done. Give the greatest pleasure to the greatest number. Express the opinions, the desires, the tastes of the majority. The majority that voted me its approval and support freely, in the shape of a 3-cent ballot dropped at the corner newsstand every morning. The Winand papers? For 31 years they have represented everybody, except Gale Winand. I erased my ego out of existence in a way never achieved by any saint in a cloister. Yet people call me corrupt. Why? The saint in a cloister sacrifices only material things. It's a small price to pay for the glory of his soul. He hoards his soul and gives up the world. But I took automobiles, silk pajamas, a penthouse, and gave the world my soul in exchange. Who sacrificed more, if sacrifice is the test of virtue? Who's the actual saint?
Gale, I didn't think you'd ever admit that to yourself.
Why not? I knew what I was doing. I wanted power over a collective soul, and I got it. A collective soul, it's a messy kind of concept. But if anyone wishes to visualize it concretely, let him pick up a copy of the New York Banner.
Yes.
Of course, Toohey would tell me that this is not what he means by altruism. He means I shouldn't leave it up to the people to decide what they want. I should decide it. I should determine. Not what I like, nor what they like, but what I think they should like, and then ram it down their throats. It would have to be rammed, since their voluntary choice is the banner. Well, there are several such altruists in the world today.
You realize that?
Of course. What else can one do if one must serve the people? If one must live for others? Either pander to everybody's wishes and be called corrupt, or impose on everybody by force your own idea of everybody's good. Can you think of any other way?
No.
What's left, then? Where does decency start? What begins where altruism ends? Do you see what I'm in love with?
Yes, Gale.
Winand had noticed that Rourke's voice had a reluctance that sounded almost like sadness.
What's the matter with you? Why do you sound like that?
I'm sorry, forgive me. It's just something I thought. I've been thinking of this for a long time, and particularly all these days when you've made me lie on deck and loaf.
Thinking about me?
About you, among many other things.
What have you decided?
I'm not an altruist, Gale. I don't decide for others.
You don't have to worry about me. I've sold myself, but I've held no illusions about it. I've never become an Alvis Garrett. He really believes whatever the public believes. I despise the public. That's my only vindication. I've sold my life, but I got a good price. Power. I've never used it. I couldn't afford a personal desire. But now I'm free. Now I can use it for what I want. For what I believe. For Dominique. For you.
Rourke turned away. When he looked back at Winand, he said only,
I hope so, Gale.
What have you been thinking about these past weeks?
The principal behind the dean who fired me from Stanton.
What principal?
The thing that is destroying the world? The thing you were talking about. Actual selflessness.
The ideal which they say does not exist?
They're wrong. It does exist. Though not in the way they imagine. It's what I couldn't understand about people for a long time. They have no self. They live within others. They live secondhand.
Look at Peter Keating. You look at him. I hate his guts.
I've looked at him. At what's left of him. And it's helped me to understand. He's paying the price, and wondering for what sin, and telling himself that he's been too selfish. In what act or thought of his has there ever been a self? What was his aim in life? Greatness. In other people's eyes. Fame, admiration, envy. All that which comes from others. Others dictated his convictions, which he did not hold. But he was satisfied that others believed he held them. Others were his motive power and his prime concern. He didn't want to be great, but to be thought great. He didn't want to build, but to be admired as a builder. He borrowed from others in order to make an impression on others. There's your actual selflessness. It's his ego that he's betrayed and given up. But everybody calls him selfish.
That's the pattern most people follow.
Yes, and isn't that the root of every despicable action? Not selfishness, but precisely the absence of a self. Look at them. The man who cheats and lies but preserves a respectable front, he knows himself to be dishonest, but others think he's honest, and he derives his self-respect from that, secondhand. The man who takes credit for an achievement which is not his own, he knows himself to be mediocre,
but he's great in the eyes of others. The frustrated wretch who professes love for the inferior and clings to those less endowed, in order to establish his own superiority by comparison. The man whose sole aim is to make money. Now, I don't see anything evil in a desire to make money. But money is only a means to some end. If a man wants it for a personal purpose, to invest in his industry, to create, to study, to travel, to enjoy luxury, he's completely moral. But the men who place money first go much beyond that. Personal luxury is a limited endeavor. What they want is ostentation, to show, to stun, to entertain, to impress others. They're second-handers. Look at our so-called cultural endeavors. A lecturer who spouts some borrowed rehash of nothing at all that means nothing at all to him. And the people who listen and don't give a damn but sit there in order to tell their friends that they've attended a lecture by a famous name. All second-handers. If I were Ellsworth Toohey, I'd say, aren't you making out a case against selfishness? Aren't they all acting on a selfish motive? To be noticed, liked, admired? By others. At the price of their own self-respect. In the realm of greatest importance, the realm of values, of judgment, of spirit, of thought, they place others above self in the exact manner which altruism demands. A truly selfish man cannot be affected by the approval of others. He doesn't need it. I think Toohey understands that. That's what helps him spread his vicious nonsense, just weakness and cowardice. It's so easy to run to others. It's so hard to stand on one's own record. You can fake virtue for an audience. You can't fake it in your own eyes. Your ego is your strictest judge. They run from it. They spend their lives running. It's easier to donate a few thousand to charity and think oneself noble than to base self-respect on personal standards of personal achievement. It's simple to seek substitutes for competence. Such easy substitutes. Love, charm, kindness, charity. But there is no substitute for competence. That precisely is the deadliness of second-handers. They have no concern for facts, ideas, work. They're concerned only with people. They don't ask, is this true? They ask, is this what others think is true? Not to judge, but to repeat. Not to do, but to give the impression of doing. Not creation, but show. Not ability, but friendship. Not merit, but pull. What would happen to the world without those who do, think, work, produce? Those are the egotists. You don't think through another's brain, and you don't work through another's hands. When you suspend your faculty of independent judgment, you suspend consciousness. To stop consciousness is to stop life. Second-handers have no sense of reality. Their reality is not within them, but somewhere in that space which divides one human body from another. Not an entity, but a relation, anchored to nothing. That's the emptiness I couldn't understand in people. That's what stopped me whenever I faced a committee. Men without an ego, opinion without a rational process, motion without brakes or motor, power without responsibility. The second-hander acts, but the source of his actions is scattered in every other living person. It's everywhere and nowhere, and you can't reason with him. He's not open to reason. You can't speak to him. He can't hear. You're tried by an empty bench, a blind mass running amok to crush you without sense or purpose. Stephen Mallory couldn't define the monster, but he knew. That's the drooling beast, he fears. The second-hander. I think your second-handers understand this, try as they might not to admit it to themselves. Notice how they'll accept anything except a man who stands alone. They recognize him at once by instinct. There's a special insidious kind of hatred for him. They forgive criminals, they admire dictators. Crime and violence are a tie, a form of mutual dependence. They need ties. They've got to force their miserable little personalities on every single person they meet. The independent man kills them, because they don't exist within him, and that's the only form of existence they know. Notice the malignant kind of resentment against any idea that propounds independence. Notice the malice toward an independent man. Look back at your own life, Howard, and at the people you've met. They know. They're afraid. You're a reproach. That's because some sense of dignity always remains in them. They're still human beings, but they've been taught to seek themselves in others. Yet no man can achieve the kind of absolute humility that would need no self-esteem in any form. He wouldn't survive. So after centuries of being pounded with the doctrine that altruism is the ultimate ideal, men have accepted it in the only way it could be accepted, by seeking self-esteem through others, by living second-hand.
and it has opened the way for every kind of horror. It has become the dreadful form of selfishness which a truly selfish man couldn't have conceived. And now, to cure a world perishing from selflessness, we're asked to destroy the self. Listen to what is being preached today. Look at everyone around us. You've wondered why they suffer, why they seek happiness and never find it. If any man stopped and asked himself whether he's ever held a truly personal desire, he'd find the answer. He'd see that all his wishes, his efforts, his dreams, his ambitions are motivated by other men. He's not really struggling even for material wealth, but for the second-hander's delusion. Prestige. A stamp of approval, not his own. He can find no joy in the struggle and no joy when he has succeeded. He can't say about a single thing, "This is what I wanted because I wanted it, not because it made my neighbors gape at me." Then he wonders why he's unhappy. Every form of happiness is private. Our greatest moments are personal, self-motivated, not to be touched. The things which are sacred or precious to us are the things we withdraw from promiscuous sharing. But now we are taught to throw everything within us into public light and common pawing, to seek joy in meeting halls. We haven't even got a word for the quality I mean, for the self-sufficiency of man's spirit. It's difficult to call it selfishness or egotism. The words have been perverted. They've come to mean Peter Keating. Gale, I think the only cardinal evil on earth is that of placing your prime concern within other men. I've always demanded a certain quality in the people I liked. I've always recognized it at once, and it's the only quality I respect in men. I chose my friends by that. Now I know what it is. A self-sufficient ego. Nothing else matters. I'm glad you admit that you have friends. I even admit that I love them. But I couldn't love them if they were my chief reason for living. Do you notice that Peter Keating hasn't a single friend left? Do you see why? If one doesn't respect oneself, one can have neither love nor respect for others. To hell with Peter Keating. I'm thinking of you. And your friends. Rourke smiled. Gale, if this boat were sinking, I'd give my life to save you. Not because it's any kind of duty, only because I like you, for reasons and standards of my own. I could die for you. But I couldn't, and wouldn't, live for you. Howard, what were the reasons and standards? Rourke looked at him and realized that he had said all the things he had tried not to say to Wynand. He answered, "That you weren't born to be a second-hander." Wynand smiled. He heard the sentence, and nothing else. Afterward, when Wynand had gone below to his cabin, Rourke remained alone on deck. He stood at the rail, staring out at the ocean, at nothing. He thought, "I haven't mentioned to him the worst second-hander of all. The man who goes after power." Chapter 12. It was April when Rourke and Wynand returned to the city. The skyscrapers looked pink against the blue sky, an incongruous shade of porcelain on masses of stone. There were small tufts of green on the trees in the streets. Rourke went to his office. His staff shook hands with him, and he saw the strain of smiles, self-consciously repressed, until a young boy burst out, "What the hell? Why can't we say how glad we are to see you back, boss?" Rourke laughed. "Go ahead. I can't tell you how damn glad I am to be back." Then he sat on a table in the drafting room, while they all reported to him on the past 3 months, interrupting one another. He played with a ruler in his hands, not noticing it, like a man with the feel of his farm soil under his fingers after an absence. In the afternoon, alone at his desk, he opened a newspaper. He had not seen a newspaper for 3 months. He noticed an item about the construction of Cortland Homes. He saw the line, "Peter Keating, architect. Gordon L. Prescott and Augustus Webb, associate designers." He sat very still. That evening, he went to see Cortland. The first building was almost completed. It stood alone on the large empty tract. The workers had left for the day. A small light showed in the shack of the night watchman. The building had the skeleton of what Rourke had designed. with the remnants of 10 different breeds piled on the lovely symmetry of the bones. He saw the economy of plan preserved, but the expense of incomprehensible features added, the variety of mottled masses gone, replaced by the monotony of brutish cubes, a new wing added with a vaulted roof, bulging out of a wall like a tumor containing a gymnasium, strings of balconies added, made of metal stripes painted a violent blue, corner windows without purpose, an angle cut off for a useless door, with a round metal awning supported by a pole, like a haberdashery in the Broadway district. 3 vertical bands of brick, leading from nowhere to nowhere. The general style of what the profession called Bronx modern. A panel of bas-relief over the main entrance, representing a mass of muscle which could be discerned as either 3 or 4 bodies, one of them with an arm raised, holding a screwdriver. There were white crosses on the fresh panes of glass in the windows, and it looked appropriate, like an error X'd out of existence. There was a band of red in the sky to the west beyond Manhattan, and the buildings of the city rose straight and black against it. Rourke stood across the space of the future road before the first house of Cortland. He stood straight, the muscles of his throat pulled, his wrists held down and away from his body, as he would have stood before a firing squad. No one could tell how it had happened. There had been no deliberate intention behind it. It had just happened. First, Toohey told Keating one morning that Gordon L. Prescott and Gus Webb would be put on the payroll as associate designers.
"What do you care, Peter? It won't come out of your fee. It won't cut your prestige at all since you're the big boss. They won't be much more than your draftsmen. All I want is to give the boys a boost. It will help their reputation to be tagged with this project in some way. I'm very interested in building up their reputation."
"But what for? There's nothing for them to do. It's all done."
"Oh, any kind of last-minute drafting. Save time for your own staff. You can share the expense with them. Don't be a hog."
Toohey had told the truth. He had no other purpose in mind. Keating could not discover what connections Prescott and Webb possessed, with whom, in what office, on what terms, among the dozens of officials involved in the project. The entanglement of responsibility was such that no one could be quite certain of anyone's authority. It was clear only that Prescott and Webb had friends, and that Keating could not keep them off the job. The changes began with the gymnasium. The lady in charge of tenant selection demanded a gymnasium. She was a social worker, and her task was to end with the opening of the project. She acquired a permanent job by getting herself appointed director of social recreation for Cortland. No gymnasium had been provided in the original plans. There were 2 schools and a YMCA within walking distance. She declared that this was an outrage against the children of the poor. Prescott and Webb supplied the gymnasium. Other changes followed, of a purely aesthetic nature. Extras piled on the cost of construction so carefully devised for economy. The director of social recreation departed for Washington to discuss the matter of a little theater and a meeting hall she wished added to the next 2 buildings of Cortland. The changes in the drawings came gradually, a few at a time. The orders okaying the changes came from headquarters.
"But we're ready to start," cried Keating.
"What the hell?" drawled Gus Webb. "Send him back just a couple of $1,000 more, that's all."
"Now as to the balconies," said Gordon L. Prescott, "they lend a certain modern style. You don't want the damn thing to look so bare. It's depressing. Besides, you don't understand psychology. The people who live here are used to sitting out on fire escapes. They love it. They'll miss it. You gotta give them a place to sit on in the fresh air."
"The cost? Hell, if you're so damn worried about the cost, I've got an idea where we can save plenty. We'll do without closet doors."
"What do they need doors for on closets? It's old-fashioned."
All the closet doors were omitted. Keating fought. It was the kind of battle he had never entered, but he tried everything possible to him, to the honest limit of his exhausted strength. He went from office to office, arguing, threatening, pleading. But he had no influence, while his associate designers seemed to control an underground river with interlocking tributaries. The officials shrugged and referred him to someone else. No one cared about an issue of aesthetics. What's the difference?
It doesn't come out of your pocket, does it?
Who are you to have it all your way? Let the boys contribute something.
He appealed to Ellsworth Toohey, But Tui was not interested. He was busy with other matters, and he had no desire to provoke a bureaucratic quarrel. In all truth, he had not prompted his protégés to their artistic endeavor, but he saw no reason for attempting to stop them. He was amused by the whole thing.
But it's awful, Ellsworth. You know it's awful.
Oh, I suppose so. What do you care, Peter? Your poor but unwashed tenants won't be able to appreciate the finer points of architectural art. See that the plumbing works.
But what for? What for? What for?
Keating cried to his associate designers.
Well, why shouldn't we have any say at all? Asked Gordon L. Prescott. We want to express our individuality, too.
When Keating invoked his contract, he was told,
All right, go ahead, try to sue the government. Try it.
At times, he felt a desire to kill. There was no one to kill. Had he been granted the privilege, he could not have chosen a victim. Nobody was responsible. There was no purpose and no cause. It had just happened. Keating came to Rourke's house on the evening after Rourke's return. He had not been summoned. Rourke opened the door and said,
Good evening, Peter.
But Keating could not answer. They walked silently into the workroom. Rourke sat down, but Keating remained standing in the middle of the floor, and asked, his voice dull,
What are you going to do?
You must leave that up to me now.
I couldn't help it, Howard.
I couldn't help it.
I suppose not.
What can you do now?
You can't sue the government.
No.
Keating thought that he should sit down, but the distance to a chair seemed too great. He felt he would be too conspicuous if he moved.
What are you going to do to me, Howard?
Nothing.
Want me to confess the truth to them?
To everybody?
No.
After a while, Keating whispered, Will you let me give you the fee?
Everything.
And
Rourke smiled.
I'm sorry, Keating whispered, looking away. He waited, and then the plea he knew he must not utter came out as,
I'm scared, Howard.
Rourke shook his head.
Whatever I do, it won't be to hurt you, Peter.
I'm guilty, too.
We both are.
You're guilty?
It's I who've destroyed you, Peter. From the beginning. By helping you. There are matters in which one must not ask for help nor give it. I shouldn't have done your projects at Stanton. I shouldn't have done the Kosmoslotnik building, nor Cortland. I loaded you with more than you could carry. It's like an electric current too strong for the circuit. It blows the fuse. Now we'll both pay for it. It will be hard on you. But it will be harder on me.
You'd rather...
I went home now, Howard?
Yes.
At the door, Keating said,
Howard, they didn't do it on purpose.
That's what makes it worse.
Dominique heard the sound of the car rising up the hill road. She thought it was Winand coming home. He had worked late in the city every night of the 2 weeks since his return. The motor filled the spring silence of the countryside. There was no sound in the house, only the small rustle of her hair as she leaned her head back against a chair cushion. In a moment she was not conscious of hearing the car's approach. It was so familiar at this hour, part of the loneliness and privacy outside. She heard the car stop at the door. The door was never locked. There were no neighbors or guests to expect. She heard the door opening and steps in the hall downstairs. The steps did not pause, but walked with familiar certainty up the stairs. A hand turned the knob of her door. It was Rourke. She thought, while she was rising to her feet, that he had never entered her room before. But he knew every part of this house, as he knew everything about her body. She felt no moment of shock, only the memory of one, a shock in the past tense. The thought, I must have been shocked when I saw him, but not now. Now, by the time she was standing before him, it seemed very simple. She thought, the most important never has to be said between us.
It has always been said, like this. He did not want to see me alone. Now he's here. I waited. And I'm ready.
Good evening, Dominique.
She heard the name pronounced to fill the space of 5 years. She said quietly, Good evening, Rourke.
I want you to help me.
She was standing on the station platform of Clayton, Ohio, on the witness stand of the Stoddard trial, on the ledge of a quarry, to let herself, as she had been then, share this sentence she heard now. Yes, Rourke. He walked across the room he had designed for her. He sat down, facing her, the width of the room between them. She found herself seated, too, not conscious of her own movements, only of his, as if his body contained two sets of nerves, his own and hers.
Next Monday night, Dominique, exactly at 11:30. I want you to drive up to the site of Cortland Holmes.
She noticed that she was conscious of her eyelids, not painfully, but just conscious, as if they had tightened and would not move again. She had seen the first building of Cortland. She knew what she was about to hear.
You must be alone in your car, and you must be on your way home from some place where you had an appointment to visit, made in advance, a place that can be reached from here only by driving past Cortland. You must be able to prove that afterward. I want your car to run out of gas in front of Cortland at 11:30. Honk your horn, and there's an old night watchman there. He will come out. Ask him to help you and send him to the nearest garage, which is a mile away.
She said steadily, Yes, Rourke.
When he's gone, get out of your car. There's a big stretch of vacant land by the road across from the building, and a kind of trench beyond. Walk to that trench as fast as you can, get to the bottom, and lie down on the ground, lie flat. After a while, you can come back to the car. You will know when to come back. See that you're found in the car, and that your condition matches its condition, approximately.
Yes, Rourke.
Have you understood?
Yes.
Everything?
Yes. Everything.
They were standing.
She saw only his eyes, and that he was smiling. She heard him say,
Good night, Dominique.
He walked out, and she heard his car driving away. She thought of his smile. She knew that he did not need her help for the thing he was going to do. He could find other means to get rid of the watchman. That he had let her have a part in this, because she would not survive what was to follow if he hadn't. That this had been the test. He had not wanted to name it. He had wanted her to understand and show no fear. She had not been able to accept the Stoddard trial. She had run from the dread of seeing him hurt by the world. But she had agreed to help him in this. Had agreed in complete serenity. She was free. And he knew it. The road ran flat across the dark stretches of Long Island, but Dominique felt as if she were driving uphill. That was the only abnormal sensation, the sensation of rising, as if her car were speeding vertically. She kept her eyes on the road, but the dashboard on the rim of her vision looked like the panel of an airplane. The clock on the dashboard said 11:10. She was amused, thinking, I've never learned to fly a plane, and now I know how it feels. Just like this, the unobstructed space, and no effort, and no weight. That's supposed to happen in the stratosphere. Or is it the interplanetary space, where one begins to float, and there's no law of gravity, no law of any kind of gravity at all? She heard herself laughing aloud. Just that sense of rising. Otherwise, she felt normal. She had never driven a car so well. She thought, it's a dry mechanical job to drive a car. So I know I'm very clear-headed, because driving seemed easy, like breathing or swallowing, an immediate function requiring no attention. She stopped for red lights that hung in the air over crossings of anonymous streets in unknown suburbs. She turned corners. She passed other cars, and she was certain that no accident could happen to her tonight. Her car was directed by remote control. One of those automatic rays she'd read about. Was it a beacon or a radio beam? And she only sat at the wheel.
It left her free to be conscious of nothing but small matters, and to feel careless and unserious, she thought, so completely unserious. It was a kind of clarity, being more normal than normal, as crystal is more transparent than empty air. Just small matters. The thin silk of her short black dress, and the way it was pulled over her knee, the flexing of her toes inside her pump when she moved her foot. Danny's Diner, in gold letters on a dark window that flashed past. She had been very gay at the dinner given by the wife of some banker, important friends of Gale's, whose names she could not quite remember now. It had been a wonderful dinner in a huge Long Island mansion. They had been so glad to see her, and so sorry that Gale could not come. She had eaten everything she had seen placed before her. She had had a splendid appetite, as on rare occasions of her childhood when she came running home after a day spent in the woods, and her mother was so pleased because her mother was afraid that she might grow up to be anemic. She had entertained the guests at the dinner table with stories of her childhood. She had made them laugh, and it had been the gayest dinner party her hosts could remember. Afterward, in the drawing room, with the windows open wide to a dark sky, a moonless sky that stretched out beyond the trees, beyond the towns, all the way to the banks of the East River. She had laughed and talked. She had smiled at the people around her with a warmth that made them all speak freely of the things dearest to them. She had loved those people, and they had known they were loved. She had loved every person anywhere on earth. And some woman had said, "Dominique, I didn't know you could be so wonderful." And she had answered, "I haven't a care in the world." But she had really noticed nothing except the watch on her wrist, and that she must be out of that house by 10:50. She had no idea of what she would say to take her leave, but by 10:45 it had been said, correctly and convincingly. And by 10:50, her foot was on the accelerator. It was a closed roadster, black, with red leather upholstery. She thought how nicely John the chauffeur had kept that red leather polished. There would be nothing left of the car, and it was proper that it should look its best for its last ride. Like a woman on her first night. I never dressed for my first night. I had no first night. Only something ripped off me, and the taste of quarry dust in my teeth. When she saw black vertical strips with dots of light filling the glass of the car's side window, she wondered what had happened to the glass. Then she realized that she was driving along the East River, and that this was New York on the other side. She laughed and thought, "No, this is not New York. This is a private picture pasted to the window of my car, all of it here, on one small pane under my hand. I own it. It's mine now." She ran one hand across the buildings from the Battery to Queensboro Bridge. "Rourke, it's mine. And I'm giving it to you." The figure of the night watchman was now 15 inches tall in the distance. "When it gets to be 10 inches, I'll start," thought Dominique. She stood by the side of her car and wished the watchman would walk faster. The building was a black mass that propped the sky in one spot. The rest of the sky sagged, intimately low over a flat stretch of ground. The closest streets and houses were years away, far on the rim of space, irregular little dents, like the teeth of a broken saw. She felt a large pebble under the sole of her pump. It was uncomfortable, but she would not move her foot. It would make a sound. She was not alone. She knew that he was somewhere in that building, the width of a street away from her. There was no sound and no light in the building, only white crosses on black windows. He would need no light. He knew every hall, every stairwell. The watchman had shrunk away. She jerked the door of her car open. She threw her hat and bag inside and flung the door shut. She heard the slam of sound when she was across the road running over the empty tract away from the building. She felt the silk of her dress clinging to her legs, and it served as a tangible purpose of flight, to push against that, to tear past that barrier as fast as she could. There were pits and dry stubble on the ground. She fell once, but she noticed it only when she was running again. She saw the trench in the darkness. Then she was on her knees at the bottom, and then stretched flat on her stomach face down, her mouth pressed to the earth. She felt the pounding in her thighs, and she twisted her body once in a long convulsion to feel the earth with her legs, her breasts, the skin of her arms. It was like lying in Rourke's bed. The sound was the crack of a fist on the back of her head. She felt the thrust of the earth against her, flinging her up to her feet, to the edge of the trench. The upper part of the Cortland building had tilted and hung still while a broken streak of sky grew slowly across it, as if the sky were slicing the building in half. Then the streak became turquoise blue light. Then there was no upper part, but only window frames and girders flying through the air, the building spreading over the sky, a long, thin tongue of red shooting from the center. Another blow of a fist, and then another, a blinding flash, and the glass panes of the skyscrapers across the river glittering like spangles. She did not remember that he had ordered her to lie flat, that she was standing, that glass and twisted iron were raining around her. In the flash when the walls rose outward, and a building opened like a sunburst, she thought of him there, somewhere beyond, the builder who had to destroy, who knew every crucial point of that structure, who had made the delicate balance of stress and support. She thought of him selecting these key spots, placing the blast, a doctor turned murderer, expertly cracking heart, brain, and lungs at once. He was there, he saw it, and what it did to him was worse than what it did to the building. But he was there, and he welcomed it. She saw the city enveloped in the light for half a second. She could see window ledges and cornices miles away. She thought of dark rooms and ceilings licked by this fire. She saw the peaks of towers lighted against the sky, her city now and his. "Rourke!" she screamed. "Rourke! Rourke!" She did not know she screamed. She could not hear her voice in the blast. Then she was running across the field to the smoking ruin, running over broken glass, planting her feet down full with each step because she enjoyed the pain. There was no pain left ever to be felt by her again. A spread of dust stood over the field like an awning. She heard the shriek of sirens starting far away. It was still a car, though the rear wheels were crushed under a piece of furnace machinery, and an elevator door lay over the hood. She crawled to the seat. She had to look as if she had not moved from here. She gathered handfuls of glass off the floor and poured it over her lap, over her hair. She took a sharp splinter and slashed the skin of her neck, her legs, her arms. What she felt was not pain. She saw blood shooting out of her arm, running down on her lap, soaking the black silk, trickling between her thighs. Her head fell back, mouth open, panting. She did not want to stop. She was free. She was invulnerable. She did not know she had cut an artery. She felt so light. She was laughing at the law of gravity. When she was found by the men of the first police car to reach the scene, she was unconscious. A few minutes' worth of life left in her body. Chapter 13. Dominique glanced about the bedroom of the penthouse. It was her first contact with surroundings she was ready to recognize. She knew she had been brought here after many days in a hospital. The bedroom seemed lacquered with light. "It's that clarity of crystal over everything," she thought. "That has remained. It will remain forever." She saw Wynand standing by her bed. He was watching her. He looked amused. She remembered seeing him at the hospital. He had not looked amused then. She knew the doctor had told him she would not survive that first night. She had wanted to tell them all that she would, that she had no choice now but to live. Only it did not seem important to tell people anything. Ever. Now she was back. She could feel bandages on her throat, her legs, her left arm. But her hands lay before her on the blanket, and the gauze had been removed. There were only a few thin red scars left. "You blasted little fool," said Wynand happily. "Why did you have to make such a good job of it?" Lying on the white pillow, with her smooth gold hair and a white high-necked hospital gown, she looked younger than she had ever looked as a child. She had the quiet radiance presumed and never found in childhood, the full consciousness of certainty, of innocence, of peace. "I ran out of gas," she said, "and I was waiting there in my car, when suddenly—"
"I've already told that story to the police, so has the night watchman. But didn't you know that glass must be handled with discretion?"
Gale looks rested, she thought, and very confident. It has changed everything for him, too.
in the same way. It didn't hurt, she said.
Next time you want to play the innocent bystander, let me coach you.
They believe it, though, don't they?
Oh, yes, they believe it. They have to. You almost died. I don't see why he had to save the watchman's life and almost take yours.
Who?
Howard, my dear. Howard Rourke.
What has he to do with it?
Darling, you're not being questioned by the police. You will be, though, and you'll have to be more convincing than that. However, I'm sure you'll succeed. They won't think of the Stoddard trial.
Oh.
You did it then, and you'll always do it. Whatever you think of him, you'll always feel what I feel about his work.
Gail, you're glad I did it?
Yes.
She saw him looking down at her hand that lay on the edge of the bed. Then he was on his knees, his lips pressed to her hand, not raising it, not touching it with his fingers, only with his mouth.
That was the sole confession he would permit himself of what her days in the hospital had cost him. She lifted her other hand and moved it over his hair. She thought, "It will be worse for you than if I had died, Gail. But it will be all right. It won't hurt you. There's no pain left in the world. Nothing to compare with the fact that we exist. He, you, and I. You've understood all that matters. But you don't know you've lost me."
He lifted his head and got up.
"I didn't intend to reproach you in any way. Forgive me."
"I won't die, Gail. I feel wonderful."
"You look it."
"Have they arrested him?"
"He's out on bail."
"You're happy?"
"I'm glad you did it, and that it was for him. I'm glad he did it." "He had to."
"Yes. And it will be the Stoddard trial again."
"Not quite."
"You've wanted another chance, Gail? All these years?"
"Yes."
"May I see the papers?"
"No, not until you're up."
"Not even the banner?"
"Particularly not the banner."
"I love you, Gail. If you stick to the end,
don't offer me any bribes. This is not between you and me, not even between him and me."
"But between you and God?"
"If you want to call it that, but we won't discuss it, not until after it's over. You have a visitor waiting for you downstairs. He's been here every day."
"Who?"
"Your lover, Howard Rourke. Want to let him thank you now?" The game mockery, the tone of uttering the most preposterous thing he could think of, told her how far he was from guessing the rest. She said,
"Yes, I want to see him. Gail, if I decide to make him my lover?"
"I'll kill you both. Now don't move, lie flat. The doctor said you must take it easy. You've got 26 assorted stitches all over you."
He walked out, and she heard him descending the stairs.
When the first policeman had reached the scene of the explosion, he had found behind the building on the shore of the river the plunger that had set off the dynamite. Rourke stood by the plunger, his hands in his pockets, looking at the remnants of Cortland.
"What do you know about this, buddy?"
the policeman asked.
"You'd better arrest me," said Rourke. "I'll talk at the trial."
He had not added another word in reply to all the official questions that followed. It was Wynand who got him released on bail in the early hours of the morning. Wynand had been calm at the emergency hospital where he had seen Dominique's wounds, and had been told she would not live. He had been calm while he telephoned, got a county judge out of bed, and arranged Rourke's bail. But when he stood in the warden's office of a small county jail, he began to shake suddenly.
"You bloody fools," he said through his teeth,
and there followed every obscenity he had learned on the waterfront. He forgot all the aspects of the situation, save one. Rourke being held behind bars. He was Stretch Wynand of Hell's Kitchen again, and this was the kind of fury that had shattered him in sudden flashes in those days, the fury he had felt when standing behind a crumbling wall waiting to be killed. Only now he knew that he was also Gail Wynand, the owner of an empire, and he couldn't understand why some sort of legal procedure was necessary, why he didn't smash this jail with his fists or through his papers. It was all one to him at the moment. He wanted to kill. He had to kill, as that night behind the wall, in defense of his life. He managed to sign papers. He managed to wait until Rourke was brought out to him. They walked out together, Rourke leading him by the wrist,
and by the time they reached the car, Wynand was calm. In the car, Wynand asked,
"You did it, of course."
"Of course."
"We'll fight it out together."
"If you want to make it your battle."
"At the present estimate, my personal fortune amounts to $40 million. That should be enough to hire any lawyer you wish, or the whole profession."
"I won't use a lawyer."
"Howard, you're not going to submit photographs again?"
"No, not this time."
Rourke entered the bedroom and sat down on a chair by the bed. Dominique lay still, looking at him. They smiled at each other. Nothing has to be said. Not this time either, she thought. She asked, "You were in jail?"
"For a few hours."
"What was it like?"
"Don't start acting about it as Gail did."
"Gail took it very badly?"
"Very."
"I won't."
"I might have to go back to a cell for years." "You knew that when you agreed to help me."
"Yes, I knew that."
"I'm counting on you to save Gail if I go."
"Counting on me?"
He looked at her and shook his head. "Dearest."
It sounded like a reproach.
"Yes," she whispered.
"Don't you know by now that it was a trap I set for you?"
"How?"
"What would you do if I hadn't asked you to help me?"
"I'd be with you in your apartment at the Enright House right now, publicly and openly."
"Yes, but now you can't. You're Mrs. Gail Wynand. You're above suspicion, and everyone believes you were at the scene by accident. Just let it be known what we are to each other, and it will be a confession that I did it."
"I see."
"I want you to keep quiet. If you had any thoughts of wanting to share my fate, drop them. I won't tell you what I intend to do, because that's the only way I have of controlling you until the trial. Dominique, if I'm convicted, I want you to remain with Gail. I'm counting on that. I want you to remain with him and never tell him about us, because he and you will need each other."
"And if you're acquitted?"
"Then..."
He glanced about the room. Wynand's bedroom.
"I don't want to say it here, but you know it."
"You love him very much?"
"Yes."
"Enough to sacrifice?" He smiled.
"You've been afraid of that ever since I came here for the first time?"
"Yes."
He looked straight at her. "Did you think that possible?"
"No."
"Not my work, nor you, Dominique. Not ever. But I can do this much for him. I can leave it to him if I have to go."
"You'll be acquitted."
"That's not what I want to hear you say."
"If they convict you, if they lock you in jail or put you in a chain gang, if they smear your name in every filthy headline, if they never let you design another building, if they never let me see you again, it will not matter. Not too much. Only down to a certain point."
"That's what I've waited to hear for 7 years, Dominique."
He took her hand, he raised it and held it to his lips, and she felt his lips where Wynand's had been.
Then he got up.
"I'll wait," she said. "I'll keep quiet. I won't come near you. I promise."
He smiled and nodded. Then he left.
It happens, upon rare occasions, that world forces too great to comprehend become focused in a single event, like rays gathered by a lens to one point of superlative brightness for all of us to see. Such an event is the outrage of Cortland. Here, in a microcosm, we can observe the evil that has crushed our poor planet from the day of its birth in cosmic ooze. One man's ego, against all the concepts of mercy, humanity, and brotherhood. One man destroying the future home of the disinherited. One man condemning thousands to the horror of the slums, to filth, disease, and death. When an awakening society with a new sense of humanitarian duty made a mighty effort to rescue the underprivileged, when the best talents of society united to create a decent home for them, the egotism of one man blew the achievement of others to pieces. And for what? For some vague matter of personal vanity. For some empty conceit.
I regret that the laws of our state allow nothing more than a prison sentence for this crime. That man should forfeit his life. Society needs the right to rid itself of men such as Howard Rourke. Thus spoke Ellsworth M. Toohey in the pages of The New Frontiers. Echoes answered him from all over the country. The explosion of Cortland had lasted half a minute. The explosion of public fury went on and on, with a cloud of powdered plaster filling the air, with glass, rust, and refuse raining out of the cloud. Rourke had been indicted by a grand jury, had pleaded not guilty, and had refused to make any other statement. He had been released on a bond furnished by Gail Winand, and he awaited trial. There were many speculations on his motive. Some said it was professional jealousy. Others declared that there was a certain similarity between the design of Cortland and Rourke's style of building, that Keating, Prescott, and Webb might have borrowed a little from Rourke. A legitimate adaptation. There's no property rights on ideas. In a democracy, art belongs to all the people. And that Rourke had been prompted by the vengeance lust of an artist who had believed himself plagiarized. None of it was too clear, but nobody cared too much about the motive. The issue was simple. One man against many. He had no right to a motive. A home built in charity for the poor. Built upon 10,000 years, in which men had been taught that charity and self-sacrifice are an absolute not to be questioned, the touchstone of virtue, the ultimate ideal. 10,000 years of voices speaking of service and sacrifice. Sacrifice is the prime rule of life. Serve or be served. Crush or get crushed. Sacrifice is noble. Make what you can of it, at the one end or the other. Serve and sacrifice. Serve and serve and serve. Against that, one man who wished neither to serve nor to rule, and had thereby committed the only unforgivable crime. It was a sensational scandal, and there was the usual noise and the usual lust of righteous anger, such as is proper to all lynchings. But there was a fierce personal quality in the indignation of every person who spoke about it. "He's just an egomaniac devoid of all moral sense," said the society woman dressing for a charity bazaar, who dared not contemplate what means of self-expression would be left to her, and how she could impose her ostentation on her friends, if charity were not the all-excusing virtue. Said the social worker, who had found no aim in life, and could generate no aim from within the sterility of his soul, but basked in virtue, and held an unearned respect from all, by grace of his fingers on the wounds of others. Said the novelist, who had nothing to say if the subject of service and sacrifice were to be taken away from him, who sobbed in the hearing of attentive thousands that he loved them and loved them, and would they please love him a little in return. Said the lady columnist, who had just bought a country mansion because she wrote so tenderly about the little people. Said all the little people, who wanted to hear of love, the great love, the unfastidious love, the love that embraced everything, forgave everything, and permitted them everything. Said every second-hander, who could not exist except as a leech on the souls of others. Ellsworth Toohey sat back, watched, listened, and smiled. Gordon L. Prescott and Gus Webb were entertained at dinners and cocktail parties. They were treated with tender, curious solicitude, like survivors of disaster. They said that they could not understand what possible motive Rourke could have had, and they demanded justice. Peter Keating went nowhere. He refused to see the press. He refused to see anyone. But he issued a written statement that he believed Rourke was not guilty. His statement contained one curious sentence, the last. It said, "Leave him alone. Please, can't you leave him alone?" Pickets from the Council of American Builders paced in front of the Cord building. It served no purpose, because there was no work in Rourke's office. The commissions he was to start had been canceled. This was solidarity. The debutante having her toenails pedicured, the housewife buying carrots from a pushcart, the bookkeeper who had wanted to be a pianist but had the excuse of a sister to support, the businessman who hated his business, the worker who hated his work, the intellectual who hated everybody. All were united as brothers in the luxury of common anger that cured boredom and took them out of themselves. And they knew well enough what a blessing it was to be taken out of themselves. The readers were unanimous. The press was unanimous. Gail Winant went against the current.
Gail!
Alva Skerritt had gasped.
We can't defend a dynamiter.
Keep still, Alva, Winant had said, before I bash your teeth in.
Gail Winant stood alone in the middle of his office, his head thrown back, glad to be living, as he had stood on a wharf on a dark night, facing the lights of a city. In the filthy howling now going on all around us, said an editorial in the Banner, signed Gail Winant in big letters, nobody seems to remember that Howard Rourke surrendered himself of his own free will. If he blew up that building, did he have to remain at the scene to be arrested? But we don't wait to discover his reasons. We have convicted him without a hearing. We want him to be guilty. We are delighted with this case. What you hear is not indignation, it's gloating. Any illiterate maniac, any worthless moron who commits some revolting murder gets shrieks of sympathy from us and marshals an army of humanitarian defenders, but a man of genius is guilty by definition. Granted that it is a vicious injustice to condemn a man simply because he is weak and small, to what level of depravity has a society descended when it condemns a man simply because he is strong and great? Such, however, is the whole moral atmosphere of our century, the century of the second rater. We hear it shouted, said another Winant editorial, that Howard Rourke spends his career in and out of courtrooms. Well, that is true. A man like Rourke is on trial before society all his life. Whom does that indict? Rourke or society? We have never made an effort to understand what is greatness in man and how to recognize it, said another Winant editorial. We have come to hold, in a kind of mawkish stupor, that greatness is to be gauged by self-sacrifice. Self-sacrifice, we drool, is the ultimate virtue. Let's stop and think for a moment. Is sacrifice a virtue? Can a man sacrifice his integrity, his honor, his freedom, his ideal, his convictions, the honesty of his feeling, the independence of his thought? But these are a man's supreme possessions. Anything he gives up for them is not a sacrifice, but an easy bargain. They, however, are above sacrificing to any cause or consideration whatsoever. Should we not, then, stop preaching dangerous and vicious nonsense? Self-sacrifice? But it is precisely the self that cannot and must not be sacrificed. It is the unsacrificed self that we must respect in man above all. This editorial was quoted in the New Frontiers and in many newspapers, reprinted in a box under the heading, Look Who's Talking. Gail Winant laughed. Resistance fed him and made him stronger. This was a war, and he had not engaged in a real war for years, not since the time when he laid the foundations of his empire amid cries of protest from the whole profession. He was granted the impossible, the dream of every man, the chance and intensity of youth to be used with the wisdom of experience. A new beginning and a climax together. I have waited and lived, he thought, for this. His 22 newspapers, his magazines, his newsreels were given the order, defend Rourke, sell Rourke to the public, stem the lynching. Whatever the facts, Winant explained to his staff, this is not going to be a trial by facts, it's a trial by public opinion. We've always made public opinion. Let's make it. Sell Rourke.